welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with the movers and shakers, those film and TV and streaming makers, the producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound editors, mixers, designers, VFX gurus, composers, stuntmen and women, and so many more. And as always, you know how much I love film and how much I like to talk about film. So it is a joy to give you a front row seat to the who, what, where, when, why, and how of movie making with these interviews. And what a terrific show I've got for you this week on Behind the Lens as I get to introduce you to a wonderful British filmmaker, writer-director John Michael Kennedy, who makes his narrative feature directorial debut with the mystery thriller, An Enemy Within. Not only is this John's narrative feature directorial debut, but as I found out, this interview that you're about to hear was his very first interview, something I found surprising given the excellence of his short films. So this is a real treat for all of you and for me. Now, there's something deliciously venomous pulsing through An Enemy Within, a tightly coiled debut narrative feature that is part gothic chamber thriller, part psychological standoff, part family blood sport. And John constructs a sharply staged mystery where inherited privilege, buried resentment, emotional insecurities, and self-delusion all become loaded weapons aimed squarely at everyone trapped inside a sprawling English estate. And the beauty of this film lies in the fact that virtually nobody inside the house deserves our trust. These are the fun ones. These are the fun kind of films, folks. Now, a brief synopsis for you. On his wedding night, Caleb Wingate, who's beautifully played by William Moseley, who you may all remember as Peter in the Chronicles of Narnia films, Caleb receives a chilling ultimatum via mysterious phone calls. Kill his wealthy father-in-law before midnight or his new bride dies. Don't you just love it? What's interesting, it's the father-in-law that whoever it is once killed, and not the mother-in-law. You know, you'd think most people, they'd go for the mother-in-law first. But not here. Of course, Caleb is marrying Julia, the youngest daughter of the Wingate's business adversary, the Forsytes. There is no love lost between these two families. As tensions escalate and a mysterious sniper known only as the Wolf closes in from outside the estate grounds, long simmering family fractures erupt into manipulation, betrayal, shifting alliances, and increasingly dangerous revelations. But while the setup initially suggests a straightforward whodunit or a contained thriller, John has far more ambitious ideas in mind for us. At its core, An Enemy Within is not about innocence corrupted. It is about people who have already compromised themselves emotionally, morally, or psychologically long before the first gun is ever raised. We've got a lot of morally bankrupt people here. The screenplay thrives on the understanding that every character sees themselves as justified. Nobody believes that they are the villain of this story. They rationalize greed, cruelty, deceit, and selfishness as necessary pathways toward happiness, security, control, or survival. Yes, every male patriarch, every head of business does shady things, corruptible things, for money in order to give their wives the diamonds, furs, trips, gowns, opulent lifestyle that the woman wants. It's really fun the way John has captured all of this and brought this to light within the film. that moral grayness is what gives the film a far richer emotional texture than many modern ensemble thrillers that rely solely on the mechanical twists and turns. And the twists here work because they feel inevitable rather than arbitrary. Because we also see a shift from the patriarchy to the matriarchy by the time we get to the third act. And that's a really interesting twist. As I said, An Enemy Within is written and directed by John Michael Kennedy, and it stars William Moseley, Patrick Bilotti, who is fantastic as Robert Forsythe. He's a scene stealer. It's no big secret. He gets shot. One of the many smatterings of gunfire that happens, but he gets shot and we see him, the color drain from his face as the blood drains from his body. And it's just fascinating to watch the maybe ultimate demise of this character. Thanks in large part to the makeup, to the camera work. But in addition to William and Patrick, we've got Kim Spearman as our blushing bride, Julia. Alexander Lincoln, who is a scene stealer, as Caleb's brother, Jackson. Tristan Gemmell, Kate Isett, Toyin Omari Kinch, Francis Wilding, Molly Dorman, and Harrison Daniels. They are our core two families of the Wingates and the Forsythes. And just so you know, it is not Forsythe, it is Forsight, Foresight. Film cinematographer is Lorenzo Livrini, the editor is Gustav Lindquist, and the composer is Caleb Blood. And yes, this is such a fun, twisting, turning mystery. I love the detail and how all of the pieces come together, and the character construct is excellent. Plus, something John does, the story stays relatively contained within the study or bar, complete with heavy tapestry draperies and the dark woods with centuries of patina, which serve as a gorgeous metaphor for the walls closing in, thanks to the man behind, thanks to this mysterious wolf who keeps calling Caleb with threats and more threats and who peppers gunfire in on a whim. And also, who the heck is he working for? A mercenary like this has got to have somebody he's working for. But the setting itself, that room, really speaks volumes. It's beautiful in telling visual grammar. Interesting, John and Lorenzo avoid ECUs. They have minimal close-ups. They stay in mid-shots or a mid-two-shot. But always giving interesting angles, such as eye level on the floor when gunshots come through the windows and folks are crawling around or trying to reach up to a doorknob, but afraid their hand might get hit by a bullet. Or, as in Robert's case, on the couch with everyone standing around, this poor, fatally wounded and dying family patriarch, as if he's already in the grave, or at least in the coffin. And then the ending is quite literally to die for. You won't see it coming. Now, in this exclusive interview with writer-director John Michael Kennedy, John provides an in-depth look at An Enemy Within, focusing on its exploration of these two dysfunctional, greedy families whose interactions are marked by betrayal and shifting alliances and money, with John emphasizing that none of the characters are truly likable or innocent. Instead, each is a puppet master at different points of the film, manipulating events for their own perceived happiness. Very much echoing themes from Shakespeare, as well as Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. That was a big inspiration for John in writing An Enemy Within. The script is carefully structured so every character's motives and actions are interconnected and suspect, creating a tapestry of suspicion and inevitable twists that feel earned rather than contrived. As I briefly mentioned, Lorenzo Lavrini's camera work is dynamic, avoiding repetitive shots, and instead offers new perspectives with each return to the central bar or study room. It enhances the feeling of a psychological standoff. The production design, despite budget constraints, is resourceful and effective. Color palette. Careful attention to color palettes of green, golds, reds, and blacks that reflect the character's emotional states and the story's escalating danger. The film's editing by Gustav Lindquist, who does an amazing job, maintains momentum and suspense, especially in the scenes that involve the wolf character, who we get glimpses of as he's in hiding, and whose surveillance. He has bugs planted in the study. He has cameras like flies on the wall, up in the corners of the ceiling. And we constantly go back to him watching glowing red infrared on a handheld monitor. And that just adds another layer of intrigue as it's peppered in between the unfolding action. And through it all, don't forget, there's a wedding reception going on in the rest of the house. So that's a lot of fun when that dawns on you in the third act. Oh my. There are people dancing and getting drunk and having a good time. Now, the sound design and the score by composer Caleb Ludd and then Julian London, blends classical and modern elements using motifs like a ticking clock to heighten the sense of urgency and reinforce the house as a character in its own right, which it truly is. It becomes, that room in particular, is a character. And it's necessary for the wolf's plot. And John also discusses the significant challenges of not only low-budget filmmaking, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic, which is when this was shot. And he finds, now, 2020 hindsight, he finds humor in the fact that there were days he came on set and he's missing his department heads because they're down with COVID and they're quarantined and other foibles that befell the production, but he soldiered through, be it for budgetary constraints as well as the pandemic. And he's got a lot to say about the house, the estate used for the location, and a lot of pearls of wisdom about the owners of these homes. When you go to a location, the relationship, the kind of relationship you want to have with the owners of homes, especially these estates and mansions, and how that makes your process so much easier. So really helpful hints in here from him for all of you filmmakers out here, especially you indie filmmakers, on things to look out for and that you might not think are that important, but can make or break you. And of course, he gives us some tidbits on upcoming projects that I, for one, cannot wait to see come to fruition. So, take a listen as writer-director John Michael Kennedy talks about An Enemy Within. Hi, John. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Just fine. So happy to be speaking to you about An Enemy Within. So thoroughly enjoyed this movie.
Oh, great to hear. That's really nice to hear.
You have two completely dysfunctional, greedy families. You have incredible personalities within each of those families. You don't like any of them, but you want to see how they're going to turn on each other because you know this is coming. This is coming.
Yeah.
From the beginning of the film, I will tell you, I figured out the several that were going to be problematic as this film played out. And
oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Because of the personas and the performances that these actors brought, yeah, so I was really happy when my theory was proven correct at the end of the film, which is half the fun in a film like this, trying to figure out who is pulling the strings, who is the puppet master.
Yeah, yeah. It has to feel somewhat inevitable, right?
Yeah.
To actually pay off. And I think that was part of the writing process, and also obviously in the casting. It was, you know, when you watch a film, you don't want to feel cheated by the twist. And
right.
It kind of, that's what was important to me, is it's not like exactly a magic trick, but it should feel like I said, inevitable that it had to be these characters.
And what's so beautiful about it is the way you've structured the script. At various points in the film, depending on the mechanics of what the Wingates are doing and what the Forsythes are doing, everybody is a puppet master at some point in this film.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everybody.
Yeah, yeah. That's something I really want to come to. You know, you said it earlier about none of them being, you know, ultimately good people. And it was... I really like films when characters, when they kind of live in the gray, which is, you know, it's more real life. And what inspired me for this film was, you know, there's a Shakespearean element to this, but it actually was from like Mary Shelley, you know, Frankenstein fame's quote of, no man chooses evil because it is evil. He only mistakes it for the happiness, the good he seeks. So for each of these characters, that's what I was trying to, like, that's the thematic behind them. Everything they're doing, they don't see as, you know, as evil necessarily. It's just, they're just seeking their own happiness within this kind of, this, you know, these two families that aren't ultimately, you know, redeeming in any way.
Yeah. I love a lot of your dialogue that you have. And, you know, we have the matriarchs of each family. And, of course, the husbands are mad because, and they're rationalizing everything that they do by, well, you want your diamonds and you want your gowns and you want your furs and you want to travel. So it's all your fault that I do these things.
Yeah.
So you've got everybody pointing fingers at everybody else.
Yeah.
And the one person that really I got the biggest kick out of is Jackson. And, of course, Alexander Lincoln is divine as Jackson. And you just know he's an ass no matter what. He is who he is who he is. He is not a wolf in sheep's clothing, pun intended. He is the one person. Oh, my God. He is who he is.
Yeah, I love that you say that, because when we were casting this, our casting director Matt Bailey was saying to me, like, you have to look at Alex for this. And then we started looking through, and then Alex sent a tape, and it was without doubt it was going to be Alex. He's just naturally charismatic. He's funny, and he has this, like, he gave Jackson this kind of, and this is what I wanted for that character. He's the most insecure person in the room.
Yeah.
At all times, and he kind of navigates that through humor, and, you know, this fake kind of alpha masculinity that he, you know, kind of puts out there. But he's ultimately just striving for a voice in the room at all times, because he's deeply insecure, but he's also most likable because I think he's most human.
And I love how he deals with everything with snark and alcohol. You can never go wrong with that combination. Snarky sarcasm and alcohol.
Yeah, that's his defense right there. So.
How challenging was it at writing this, John, because of so many different personalities? Because at first we think we've only got a few people to concern ourselves with. But as we get to like that, I'd say the 41-minute mark of the film, this people that we thought were insignificant are no longer insignificant, and they are part of the bigger tapestry. This could not have been easy crafting the personalities of each of these individuals and then making them mesh so that they clash.
Yeah. I mean, it's very hard when, you know, I was inspired by, you know, these kind of films. Actually, the film for me was inspired by The Game, ultimately. You know, that. So that was like where the original inspiration came from. And, you know, a lot of that goes back to like being a fan of David Fincher and his work there as well. But it's also like it has this kind of Knives Out thing, and it's, you know, it's very relevant to Knives Out. Maybe even Succession was quite inspiring for this. But it's, for me, it was just, you know, you've got all these actors. The hardest thing about crafting that in a script is tracking them and making sure they're all making the right decisions and the right kind of actions off the back of another person's line while staying true to their motives or lack thereof. But yeah, it was fun and very a great feeling when, you know, the script is finished. But yeah, it sends you into a bit of a frenzy trying to make sure that, you know, there's no holes, you know, while staying true to this whole like new money, old money, and an understanding of where they would be coming from, being from different environments. Yeah, it was complicated, but, you know, I think I got it pretty close to where I wanted it to be. So yeah.
Well, it's very effective on screen, and that's what counts, is how is this coming across? But at the same time, not only what I really appreciate that you did was visually, logistically, you kept this film contained. We're in one location. Yeah. And then after like the half hour mark, the 40 minute mark, we are in an even smaller location. We're in that den, that library. Yeah. So you really, you then turn the tables, you and your DP, Lorenzo Lavrini.
That's fantastic, Lorenzo.
Beautiful work there in terms of the lighting, of using those dark woods to your advantage, creating some negative space in the corners. You've got your production design with the heavy draperies. And you really feel the walls metaphorically closing in on these two families.
I love that you say that because when I was working with Lorenzo, who is super talented and so fast as well on a particular budget like this, and, you know, it's such a scale of a project with a wedding ceremony. I would advise that to another indie, you know, sub-million budget. It's pretty difficult. But we were really focused on, like, you know, when it came to the camera, was, you know, we knew the machine, let's pick the right equipment. We're going to machine a lot of low light. It's very, you know, night heavy. Film. Obviously, with it being contained, you have to keep it dynamic. So we, you know, the idea was to create this kind of like, you know, this setup of Act One, creating this big production value as much as we possibly could, while at the same time, kind of, you know, some of the tools we utilized the most were like compressing the space around Caleb as the story moved forward. We'd also, there's kind of cool little moments, like when he gets the first call, we close in on Caleb at that point when he gets the first call from the wolf. And then it's kind of, you know, we played with steady there a little bit as well, where it's more on autopilot for Caleb. And then other things that we worked with were, you know, creating this kind of wide scale at the beginning was like showing this, you know, this wonderful house that we used in Hereford, the Mind, with a fantastic owner called Sarah. She was incredible to work with, just showing this kind of like the idea to show who this family is before we get into the house on a grander scale, before we close in around them and show their world falling apart. And, you know, and showing that all families kind of have their issues, even these privileged families, even more so in some ways. Mm-hmm. And then the color was really important to us. We really thought about color palette, you know, for like the greens on the outside, creating that kind of thriller aspect, how it's kind of cold around them because they're very cold people. Mm-hmm. If you get to know them. And then within the house, you know, there's greens and golds, and then that becomes more green and kind of sickening. But when we get into this, into that room, and I think this is what I'm trying to get to, obviously when we get into that one bar room, is we're going to spend a lot of time there. So that was really important that we got the right colors, and obviously the reds and the blacks and the dangers, and it allowed us to play a lot with shadow work in there, creating more suspicion shots, which was something we really focused on, was creating these kind of assassin entries from the characters wherever we could, and you know, some cowboy shots that like actually are inspired by The Favourite, you know, those great long kind of, you know, in the great westerns. It's just like I wanted to try and like me and Lorenz, I wanted to try and get this visual kind of narrative across that this is kind of a standoff, you know. And you know, we actually had some things we couldn't do that we really wanted to do. There was we were going to use when they were initially having the first conversation, we were going to have like all these kind of like bearskin rugs on the floor, etc. When they were initially having their talk at the beginning of the film, was we kind of put a few things in there, but we just didn't have the budget to do like the big epic scale in the bar where we were going to put these like lion heads around them. So it's like they went from the predator to the prey in this room. So you know, there's certain things that the budget wouldn't allow for, but I think it still allowed us to create a very cool aesthetic within that room and a great staging for the actors to move around, which is so difficult with that many people in one room.
I love your use of that room, and I love the fact the film opens and it's the same room, but the curtains are, they're open and there's light streaming through, although it's not sun. It's a gray day, but it's that stark kind of glare light that you still want to put your sunglasses on because it's hurting your eyes. So you think you see everything exposed. That opening within the first less than 7 minutes. And then you're sitting there gobsmacked. It's like, oh my God. And then we get the little Chiron. It says 3 months later and we're back. And then we really start to see things take shape. And what we thought we saw in that room with the bright light of day and all suddenly is not that at all. The appearances are deceiving. And you darken up. What you do in that room is spectacular. And then, like you said, with the camera, you don't go in for extreme close-ups in this film. Yet you hone in on close-ups like Robert when he's on the couch. Camera comes in tighter. It's close, but it's not a close-up and definitely not an ECU. But there are so many people milling about, and we don't know what they are doing around him. Is somebody grabbing a statue and is going to bash him over the head? Because the anger, the testosterone is so high, we don't know what actually is going to happen. And when we finally get to this third act, in the meantime, you're editing. Gustav did a beautiful job with the edit. And in going back and forth just enough with the wolf. And every time we went back to the wolf, we're getting the red infrared surveillance look, the red on his little monitor that he has. So it gets even darker and more mysterious. But you keep us in the game as to, he's just as interested in watching all of this unfold on his surveillance cameras as we are.
He's still trying to find the truth himself, ultimately. It's not exactly what he believes it to be, which without saying too much, I guess, just in case.
Yeah, but we don't want to spoil.
So I'll be careful there. But, you know, for me, I love how you talk about the testosterone of, like, the patriarchy and knowing the film and where it goes with the matriarchy. I think it passes over really well. And through the edit, Gustav and I spent a lot of time trying to make sure it was super dynamic and moving momentum, like there was a momentum each time. And, you know, this actually correlates with Lorenzo, the cinematographer, and Gustav. And what we wanted to make sure that each time we went back in that room, it felt different. It was moving forward. It wasn't shot the same. Each one, each time we went in, you were going to get a new experience within the bar.
Yeah.
To keep it, you know, exciting for the audiences, you know, which also kept it exciting for the cast because I knew each time it was like a different scene on a stage, you know.
And each time we're seeing something else about each one of these characters. As we go, as we move about the room and the camera angles change, we learn more about each character with each shift in the camera POV, such as Philip crawling on the floor and running his mouth off at the same time. We're hearing new things come from him. We're hearing different things come from the women. Of course, it is fun, Robert's wife, you know, it is fun that she wants to inflict pain on him and stitch up his wound.
Yeah, she's great, you know, she did a great job in that role.
Oh, my God, she is fantastic. But at every turn, we get a different angle and a different perspective, be it on the floor or right on up to the red infrared that the wolf is seeing. Where the camera is placed in the top corner of the room, like a fly on the wall. So you put so much thought into constructing this visually, John.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's, for me, it was, there's so many red herrings in it and possibilities of plants. And, one of the most important things about these films is planting and paying off. And I do think we did that pretty well. I mean, I had a fantastic cast and crew on this. They were all amazing. Will did an unbelievable job playing Caleb. I thought he was, he brought it every day, especially on a shoot like this, which is very difficult. Because we actually ran into, like, we had to push a couple times of COVID, then we got hit by COVID during production. And,
oh, my God.
2 week circuit breaker. So I think that was actually the most difficult thing because as a cast and a crew, everyone came together on this, and we were really swimming for the first 11 days. We found our groove, and then everyone started dropping like flies. to the point we were like riding on the fly, and I was turning up and like, who's in today? Like, there's a few things that we had to, you know, adapt to, which worked creatively. We just kind of had to lean into it. It was kind of crazy. My HOD isn't here today. Oh, my talent's not here today. Who's in? It was to the point I spent as limited amount of time around anybody and was sleeping in my car at lunch and stuff because I was just like, I can't catch it. And I was like double masked up, but you know, because I didn't feel like we'd finish the film if we had to go longer than a 2 week circuit breaker and much and many more problems hit us. So I feel like it was everybody pulling together from the cast and crew, great production team like Guy Davis and stuff. It was like really helping us get it over the line
and I have to say, casting William Moseley as Caleb, that is brilliant, because everybody that sees him immediately thinks of him as Peter in the Chronicles of Narnia.
And I think it's a nice turn for him. I think he does it really, you know, it's a great role for him.
This is perfect, because we all think of this fresh-faced, earnest, eager young man, and that is who Caleb is. He's fresh-faced, eager, he has his beautiful new bride with him, Julia, and he's going to be so happy, and then he starts getting weird phone calls.
And you
feel so badly for him, and it's like, oh my God, this poor kid, because you still see him as a kid. And so I think that was brilliant, bringing him in for that role.
Yeah, it was definitely a no-brainer when I spoke to Will. Will's fantastic to work with. He's such a generous human being. He's a really great guy. And, you know, he worked really well with Alex as well, as the brothers. I was like, this is meant to be. They look perfect together. You know, and it was just like, and it, when you really, I think this is going to be something, just for Will, it's just for people to see him in this kind of, you know, light, ultimately. And I think it's going to be great, but it's, he played it fantastically well, and you know, I think it was a sum of all parts as well, with everyone else like Patrick, Bellotti, who played Robert, and, you know, Tristan, William, Kate, Kim's, Kate was brilliant as Barbara as well. She really brought that very emotive moment that we can't talk about. But then it was, you know, Kim Spearman, who played Julia, was phenomenal throughout as well. And, you know, I have to give a special mention out to Harrison Daniels, who played the Wolf. I thought he was really great as well. He's also such a nice guy, and it's like playing that role is not that easy, I wouldn't think. And Toyin, who played Philip, was fantastic as well. And it's like one of the things we try to do with this film, and I don't want to forget it because I do want to give back to the HODs where I can, because like I said, they were great on costume. We really tried to focus on each of these characters feeling an individual within the families, mm-hmm. and I think they did a fantastic job of that. I think, like, one thing I was shocked about was when the costume team brought in, you know, these costumes, and you're like, as a director, like, I'm not sure, and then they put it on, and I was like, I'm totally, yeah, you guys are totally right, this looks fantastic, and this really works, and it kind of really helped set the tone with the costumes to the background, and what each of these people meant in that, particularly someone like Philip as well, with, you know, his kind of like a look was definitely outside of what the rest of the room felt like. And then on makeup, you know, they did a fantastic job. The special effects was great. And it always looked real ultimately, even though it's kind of elevated. The other thing I would say is, I'll actually just finish that one comment there. Yeah, and production design, it was just, you know, they did so much of the budget they had, they were so resourceful, and yeah, I felt like, you know, the location was incredible, and then production design took it to another level.
Now, I have to say, the makeup on Robert, that is so well done in terms of they're draining the life from him, and his face is getting pastier and whiter as we go. Yeah. Now, I'm guessing you weren't shooting this in chronological order, were you?
No, it was Brooke, it's an incredible makeup artist and special effects. I don't even know how they managed to do that. And even for Patrick, in and out of makeup like that was just, like I said, there was. I didn't have one member ever say of his cast and crew, I don't want to do that. I mean, it was a very difficult shoot, particularly after the COVID and how we lost like days on the schedule, so we were really shooting, you know, way too many scenes in a day actually. But no one complained; they all just kept turning up. I honestly don't think this film would be made without that kind of mentality.
Yeah, you know, I would be remiss not to bring up one of the highlights of the film in the third act. When everybody knows the wolf is after them, nobody knows why the wolf is trying to take them out. Granted, we've had William yelling that, you know, if the sniper wanted you dead, you'd be dead. So he doesn't want you dead. And then they decide they're going to take up arms. And to see them all come out, women and all, with shotguns. It's like, and they all looked like they were going on an African safari hunt to kill lions and tigers and bears. As they go into the wedding reception party area, which is the complete opposite in terms of visual tone from what we've been seeing, that was one of the funniest sequences to see them there. Some of them are bloodied. They've got shotguns raised. And then it's the women who start firing and taking control.
And that was I'm glad you see that. That was the kind of the passing of the torch, right, in those moments. And it's like, it's funny you say that shot. We got that in one take. So there was quite a few, like, those shots that were like one or two takes. Particularly because they were on the back end, and like I said, we lost a few days, and you really had to pick out those moments. I mean, you know, we actually had a trunk shot at the beginning of the film, which kind of paid homage to like the Ritchies and the Tarantinos, film their work. But I couldn't we couldn't do it on the back end, so we actually had to remove it from the front. Because without the plan, without the payoff, there's no real plan.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a couple of, like, restrictions that, like, I watch it and go, it would have looked so cool. But, yeah, I still love that. And it maybe kind of grounded it a little bit more in the moment. But, yeah, I love how they leave that. And then all of a sudden they're coming down the stairs with all the guns. It's fantastic.
And just the whole visual tonal bandwidth contrast with this party scene. And then it dawns on you, oh, my God, they've all been locked in this study, in this bar room, dark, cloaked, kind of, you get a sense of fortification because of the wood paneling in the room. But at the same time, hey, this party's been going on. And it just, it's so striking when you're watching this. But that visual tonal bandwidth contrast is so superb.
Yeah.
And the way that you turn the party into the reality of the situation with the women firing off rifles is just superb. Superb.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think that's the biggest thing about these plans and payoffs with, like, is seeing Julia with the gun at the beginning. It's like, it was coming at all times. But it's like, to me, that's why it powered the script for me, and it was... it's hard to notice because, the budget kind of restricted us, but, Kim plays Julia, always had some kind of butterfly element to her, which I can't really go too much into, but it's, like, it was... You know, that was kind of the rising in some ways for her character, ultimately, and that was kind of planted throughout. There's a few things we would have done more with more budget, but it's still subtle enough, and I think it's present at times. But yeah, it was definitely passing over a lot more as we go in. And I thought, you know, Julia's speech in the bar when she's with Caleb and Robert is great, when she kind of has that mini monologue to kind of show that she's the little boss. Yeah, that was kind of a pinnacle point for the matriarchy.
Yeah, she's not some wilting flower hiding in a corner.
No, we see that at some point.
Now, something I'm curious about, John, is I have spoken with so many filmmakers, and they have shot in these old stately mansions and estates, and then they are limited by what they can do within the structure itself in terms of you can't drill holes for lights, you can't do this, you've got to put up fake walls, you've got to... You know, you've got to have cranes outside shooting in. Did you encounter those kind of restrictions with this particular estate?
So a bit of backstory I should give you is I scouted about 70 different stately homes throughout the UK.
Oh, my God.
Scotland and Wales. And I did find one that I really liked that was in Oxford. But like I said, we got pushed on schedule. And that was a fantastic location. And then I like Fincher films like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. You know, I always imagined that the building would be white to show some kind of, you know, kind of that, you know, privilege, a lot of like the elitism and stuff. And then have these reds and blacks inside and, you know, and kind of be able to play with the tone and texture of, I guess, you know, blood in relation to the betrayals, et cetera, in the story. But yeah, it was, you know, some you're not really just buying into these locations. You're buying into the person that owns the location or manages it. And Sarah at the Mint, I can't speak any higher of her. Her whole family were fantastic. Not very restrictive. Restrictive where I would also say if this was my house, I wouldn't be comfortable with that. But they run it really well as a production. They work with the teams. So honestly, we didn't have much problem there. She was actually bringing me lunch sometimes. So she was so kind, and they were, you know, I felt like a part of the family when I was there, because she was like, "Oh, you must be so stressed out with the COVID, and you're trying to finish this, and they were very adaptable for us." And I got really lucky in the end, even though I knew I was going off instinct that it was the right pick. But yeah, I think my only advice to any filmmaker, you know, although this was the perfect location for this film, it's really who owns that property, who manages it. You really need to you know, take a look at that number and see if it has that, has the worth that you're going to need for your scene. Because, like I said, my cast and crew brought everything to the table, and she's a part of that team. She really helped us get there.
That's fantastic. Now, one other element of this film I've got to ask you about, John, is your music. What were you You've got Caleb Blood's score. What were you looking for musically for this? You got your dual tonalities happening here, and we're getting increasingly more insane, darker, family infighting, new family infighting. So what were you looking for musically to buttress or capture this?
So musically, it was actually a combination between Caleb Spiros, who handled the mix for known for years as well, and kind of leaning, and obviously knowing that Julian Lennon was going to put his music to this, which is, you know, we got very lucky. It sounds great, and it's great to have him on this project, and you know, his songs really play into this. But you know, it was, you know, for me, it was like the house had to have a feeling, and it had to be a character within this type of film, much like most contained thrillers, where I think if you don't focus on that being a character in it, you can kind of feel there's an emptiness to the story. So, you know, it had to feel somewhat kind of like progressive and ultimately kind of mechanical, as like these kind of... as we started to reveal who these people were, and kind of, but like, it's like, I wanted to feel like this was just a story within, a chapter within the story of this house, you know, it's been around for hundreds of years. And that's with the Foley and the sound effects and everything. It had to feel, I was always trying to focus on sonically trying to elevate it. But ultimately what I wanted it to do was feel classically kind of composed, but modernize that for this piece to what these families are doing now. Because when you have new money and old money in the, you know, they're both fighting for that kind of that turf. The new money wants to be recognized as old money, and the old money wants the world to stay the same way. So yeah, it's kind of, for me, it was just, you know, Kayla did a fantastic job on that. Spiros did a fantastic mix, and just bringing Julian's music in, it was kind of really serendipitous at that point.
Well, personally, I think you could have actually gone back to an old Western and had a gunfight at the OK Corral music, and it would have been perfect.
That would have been fun. I like that.
That would have worked too. In that,
you know what? I should have put that. I should have put that in. There's a shot where they're all around Robert, all the men, and it's like a coffin.
Yeah,
open casket. It's almost like a boardroom shot as well. That was kind of like they all stood around thinking what to do, and that would have been an OK Corral moment for sure. That'd have been brilliant. That's actually one of my favorite shots, is because Robert, you know, I was speaking to Patrick, he's like, oh, it came out, and he goes, it feels like I was at a funeral. I was like, yeah, that's exactly how it was meant to feel.
That's exactly how it looks when you're watching it.
Yeah.
It's like they're all standing around, and it's like they're waiting for him to take his last breath. They've already got him. He doesn't have one foot on the grave and the other on the banana peel. He's got 2 feet in the grave, and the hands are grabbing at the banana peel to not go all the way in.
We're talking about your business advantages at this point. I forgot one thing with Caleb and Spiros, what they had to work on as well, because, you know, Up in the Stakes was showing that, you know, we have the grandfather clock in the back to remind us that there's a timer on those. But there's also the ticking clock throughout the composition, the musical score and composition and playing the harp. It was like, that was a constant reminder that time is ticking. So that is something we definitely implemented into it to keep the stakes high and the audience engaged.
And the ticking clock inserted within the composition and within the soundscape, it works so well, because you really do feel like this is happening in the course of a night. You don't draw it out. So that it's like, my God, how long are they in this room? Is it a week? Is it 3 days? Is it 4 days? No.
Yeah.
We are constantly reminded. So it feels, we feel the urgency of time passing. And I like how you did that. Now, I've got one more thing I've got to ask you about. This is your first narrative feature, is it not?
Yes, this is, yeah.
So, what did you learn in surviving this experience of making your first narrative feature as a filmmaker that you can take forward into your next projects?
Yeah, I think what I know what I would take straight away is that some of all parts come in, just making sure you have a great crew and a great cast that is motivated for all the right reasons. I would also, you know, as a first film, I think just like I said, just going with your gut instincts on the house that you pick, the place called the Mind, which was, I think just always going with your gut and kind of locking in to what the story is you're actually trying to tell, and focusing on not trying to go for like what's going to look great on a trailer, but what's going to look great as a movie and as a whole solid piece. Because one of the things we did in the edit was we had some really nice one shots that we had to remove because they were planted at the beginning and then we couldn't shoot them.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt like out of balance, and it just sometimes understanding and I said, no, you're just going to have to make, you're going to have to bend at some point, and that's okay, and just be creative with it and stay positive. But yeah, I think what I've learned from this is just that, I know I went through like a COVID thing, which is a whole thing, but I just kind of push through and, get through every wall that comes through, because it's never easy, but is it worth it? It's totally worth it. I love what we achieved as a team, and I think that's a big part of this. It's a collaboration, and you can't do it without each other.
Well, a superb job. I really like this film. I like your directorial voice and your visual execution, and I can't wait to see what you bring us next.
Yeah, we're actually working on a couple next, so the next one hopefully goes up towards the end of this year. So it's actually set in the Birmingham, UK, London, just a Peaky Blinders fame. But it's more of a modern-day kind of gangland vigilante film.
Ooh, more guns!
Yeah,
more guns!
More guns, more action. it's a really kind of big action contained again, actually, somewhat. I found another way to contain it, which is kind of cool. Now I'll take some of what I've learned from this to that. And then it's just, a sci-fi thriller that's kind of in that Ex Machina kind of fold that we're putting together now as well. So that's next couple of years.
Well, I can't wait to see. I'll see anything that you do, John. I really...
I appreciate you, Emma.
I really
so much.
Love your work here, and hopefully we'll get to chat again in the future.
I would love to. I'd love to. This is my first interview, so thank you.
I got to be your first interview. I feel so lucky.
Yeah.
This is great. Oh my!
I don't know. I feel lucky because this is really nice to talk about, all the creative elements and finally. My team get to hear how much I enjoy the process with them, considering everything. But, yeah.
Well, you definitely did. It shows on the screen.
All right.
You can't make a film like this unless you're enjoying what's happening along the way to get there.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
This has been so wonderful, John. Now you go have a great rest of your day, rest of your evening.
Yeah.
And just look forward to when the film releases, next week?
Next week, yeah.
So,
15th.
I can't wait to hear what people have to say about it. John?
Thank you.
Thank you so, so much. And that was John Michael Kennedy going in-depth on An Enemy Within, his narrative feature directorial debut. When you see it, you're not going to believe it's his first feature. I'm not going to believe it. And you can see An Enemy Within on digital and on demand starting this Friday, May 15th. Now, a couple of other films I briefly want to mention to you today that are absolute must-see films. First is The Sheep Detectives, which is a tale that follows George Hardy, beautifully played by Hugh Jackman, as a shepherd who loves to read murder mysteries to his sheep, never suspecting that they can understand him. When George is found dead under mysterious circumstances, the sheep decide to solve the crime themselves, even if it means leaving their meadow for the first time and facing the fact that the human world isn't as simple as it appears in books. This is the most delightful film of the year. It makes your heart smile. You laugh, you cry, you fall in love with these fluffy balls of wool. The Sheep Detective is in theaters right now and is based on the 2005 mystery novel Three Bags Full, A Sheep Detective Story by Leonie Swann. The other film you must see, and please have boxes of tissues next to you when you watch this, that is also based on a novel, and that is Remarkably Bright Creatures. It's on Netflix now. It stars Sally Field as an older widow named Tova, whose life is changed by a friendship with a giant Pacific octopus named Marcellus, and Cameron, a new-in-town employee looking for his father, who is fabulously played by Lewis Pullman. Sally and Lewis is the new pairing we didn't know we needed. Sally and Marcellus is the new pairing we didn't know we needed. As you watch this film, you know, we need them. Alfred Molina voices Marcellus and is so wonderful, so soothing. I could listen to him all day as Marcellus. Now, this is Remarkably Bright Creatures is based on Shelby Van Pelt's best-selling novel. And as with The Sheep Detectives, is one of the rare instances where the film is better than the book. And I know over the past 44 years, you have rarely heard me say that. And here, both books are fantastic. So these adaptations, it makes the screenwriting and the performances and the direction even more impressive. Now, if you still haven't seen Rennie Harlan's Deep Water, get to the theater now and kick off the start of summer right. With sharks and a plane crash, disaster and survival, you can't beat it. And here again, if you missed last week's show, go back and listen to it. It's Rennie talking about Deep Water, Rennie and me. And so much of the film we didn't even get to cover and talk about. But Rennie is a master of practicality, practical effects, in-camera effects, build a plane, break it apart, put people in 10 tons of water. So, see it. And of course, as with Rennie's films, because he's so passionate about sound design, I got to tell you, I saw it in the theater. My first screening of the film was at home. I have now gone back after that first screening and after talking with Rennie, I had time to go to the theater and see it on the big screen in Dolby Atmos. The sound is spectacular, as is the huge big screen format. So I didn't go back just once. I went back twice. So I've seen Deep Water three times now, and I will probably see it a fourth while it's still in theaters. But you need to see that. You need to see The Sheep Detectives in theaters right now. You need to sit back at night and relax and watch Remarkably Bright Creatures on Netflix and come Friday, digital, on demand, see An Enemy Within. So, that is all the time we have today. I'll be back next week with more interesting interviews and a look at some more films. Make sure to check out the website, behindthelensonline.net, where I've got more new interviews and reviews, a whole slew of them, plus highlights of the 2026 TCM Classic Film Festival, including lots of photographs and 15 red carpet interviews that are entertaining and insightful. And I'm hearing back from a lot of you already that you're loving my interview with Ethan Peck, Gregory Peck's grandson. Especially where he opines and wonders about could his grandfather, what would he have been like cast as Mr. Spock in a Star Trek series? It's a fun interview. They're all really good interviews, and a lot of fun. So please go to the website, check it all out. And until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.